From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Jill Dittmeyer. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerub Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album. It's available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today I'll get a sneak preview of an art exhibit at the Stutz Art Gallery that's displayed at Kid Height.
You'll also learn about this year's AIA Architects Home Tour.
And I'll talk with two of the artistic directors of the Ronen Chamber Ensemble. We'll also have that arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do? All of that and more right after the latest news from NPR. Lots of art forms are available to your children. Think of family concerts, kids' theater, workshops, or children's choirs. Well, starting on October 7th, the Stutz Art Gallery will add fine art to that list by displaying professional-level fine art at kids' eye level, about 30 inches high. Now, this exhibit will be produced in partnership with Just My Height Art Shows. It's an organization devoted to engaging children in art. The exhibit will invite all visitors, but especially young children, to touch, smell, open, close, and view the artwork on display. Sharon Gamble invited the exhibit's curator, Lee Dunnington-Jones, and artist Kat Silver to tell her more.
Kid Height art, but not necessarily just for kids, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
It's fine art hung at kid height. It's a trademark exhibit called Just My Height. I'm working with a woman in Florida who has started this whole idea. And I have collected artists from across the city to really think out of the box about the kind of art they want to present. But it's fine art. It's adult art. There's some kid-centric pieces in it, and there are some pieces that will be touchable and interactive.
What does kid-centric piece mean?
Colorful.
I see.
Interactive.
Okay.
Things that will be definitely interesting for kids. And it's hung at 30 inches. And so they will be able to interact completely with the art in a way that they don't normally get to do. They usually have to stand on the floor and look up, and so
sure,
they get a completely different perspective. And the adults that come will get also a completely different perspective because they'll be bending down and looking at things in ways that they have not.
Kat, when you first heard about this show, they're not in the studio with us, but you have a couple of kids.
I do.
And,
yes,
too. And so you had kind of a built-in test audience. But what was your first impression when you thought, oh, that's a this is a new idea? What did you think?
I thought it was a great idea. I jumped right on it. Yeah.
What appealed to you?
Well, actually, the first thing that caught my eye was the theme, which is secret doors, mm-hmm, which I thought was just really intriguing. A lot of my pieces have a sort of a mystery-type fantasy feel anyways, and I had recently done a few pieces with houses and doors and things. So I had a few that I thought would fit really well with the show, and then I also was inspired to make a new piece, which had to do with like a tree with a hidden door, and then an underground tunnel system where rabbits are burrowing, and they actually have a whole like network of rooms where they're doing different things inside the room. So sort of a secret life of bunny rabbits.
Oh, cool. It's a world that we don't get to see. So Ivy and Winter, remind me how old they are?
So 4 and 2, basically.
4 and 2. So they must be fascinated by doors.
Oh, yes. They are very fascinated by doors. And the new painting that I'm doing with the rabbits, my oldest daughter, Winter, has been pointing and asking me questions already about, well, what are these bunny rabbits doing? And, oh, this one's reading a story, and this one's taking a bath, and that sort of thing. So I think the kids are really going to love it.
Do your girls ask you questions about making art?
Oh, they love to make art. Every time I pick up a brush, they're right on top of it, painting right next to me. Yeah, absolutely.
And the bunny rabbits have a symbolism
they do
in your paintings.
Ah, tell us.
Well, actually, about 5 or 6 years ago, I started noticing rabbits everywhere. I decided to look up what their meaning was. And in Native American tradition, the rabbits are a symbol to your shadow self, so the parts of yourself that you might be afraid of.
Really?
They actually encourage you to live life more to the fullest, to face your fears, not hold back, and that sort of thing. So for me, that's what they represent.
Oh, and the richness of this underground shadow life.
Yeah.
Ooh. Well, we won't talk to your daughters about that just yet. But when they're teenagers, they'll be hip to that concept. Lee, tell me more about this national idea, how it came about, and why it's not just about allowing children, people of not very many years, to see art, to experience art.
I met Christine Lyall from Just My Height through one of our Stutz artists who participated in one of her exhibits in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
So this concept started with her in Miami. And I've been working with her since February of this year. We applied for a grant from the Penrod Society to be able to put on this exhibit.
Great.
And we've been working together, Christine and I, for all these months, developing the concept, writing the call for artists, collecting the artists, and working on how to present the show. One of the things that's going to be done at our exhibit is to conduct a scavenger hunt, and Christine will have images of all of the art that's going to be in the show, and we'll create questions for three different age groups of kids.
Oh,
that sounds really cool.
Yeah.
And then they'll go through and look at each of the pieces of art and answer the scavenger hunt questions. So, I mean, it's an excellent opportunity for both for the artists to really be looked at and analyzed, but also for the kids to look for elements and begin to be able to understand the concept that art is not always what it appears to be.
Yeah, I just had flashed on a vision of children running through the gallery. So it's a good thing there are some touchable pieces. So
wouldn't it be the first time mine have run through there quite a few times already.
And you know, there's nothing wrong with that kind of excitement. I think sometimes you've certainly met people, as have I, who are a little timid about going to a gallery opening or any art form, going to the symphony, going to a hip hop concert, because they maybe don't. They feel like they don't have the vocabulary. Somebody will stop them and say, what do you think? And they feel like, that's a specialized field. I don't understand.
But this is an opportunity for everyone to really look at the art. And we have some really wonderful pieces. We have installation pieces. We have sculptures. We have a welded tree with a tiny secret door at the bottom.
Ooh.
6 feet tall. And
wow. I wonder if that door eventually leads to a passage that leads to the bunny world.
Maybe.
Possibly. Definitely possible.
So in addition to children, this gives grown-up people who use a wheelchair to get around, people who,
exactly,
for some reason or other, maybe it's easier to see art hung at this level, right?
Yes, exactly.
What do we know about this national idea about how much that was the intent?
Oh, whether anybody that is height challenged?
Yeah.
I don't know anything about that.
We'll find out when the feedback from this gallery show. Yeah. Tell me about some of the more unusual ideas that came over the transom when you said this secret doors idea, and it's going to be hung at a different height, everybody.
Yes.
Or installed at a different height.
We have a video piece coming that is a whole little story about a kid who finds an egg, and the egg is a key to different worlds, and we're going to use that to launch our scavenger hunt. We have an installation piece that is made out of doors. It's going to be 8 feet tall and 10 feet wide, and it's a Japanese wave cut in levels, so it'll be like, 18 inches deep.
Wow.
And there'll be lights inside of it to make the edges of the wave glow, and we're going to use that to help to partition off the part of the gallery that the video will be shown in, and we're going to have a secret door to lead into the secret space.
Wow. Sounds like the gallery is really transformed.
I think it really is. I'm so excited about the response I've had from artists about this and their willingness to work with each other, like the guy with the installation piece is working with the gal with the video piece so that we can use one to lead into the other.
Uh-huh.
It's been most exciting.
Kat, when you decided this is a show you wanted to be a part of, how did you decide what pieces you had already created to reach back for?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I had, like I mentioned, I had several that had like houses or doors on them, but I really just thought about what would be like secret about it, like what would kind of draw people in. The one piece that I chose that is one of my favorites is a house with legs, human legs, kind of walking down or up. You can't really tell if it's going forward or backwards, but it's going down a winding road. And so for me, that was like kind of interesting because like, how do you even get up into the door? Because there's, there's really no way to get up in there. And there's also a silhouette of a person kind of taking a ride in the house, which
Ooh.
I thought was kind of interesting and secretive. And then the other piece I chose is a one that I had already completed is a female head figure with like a puppet mouth. So her mouth is actually the door. So her mouth is kind of hanging open and there's a little ladder that comes out from her teeth. And there are little bunny rabbits around the bottom that are waiting to go up into the ladder. So
wow.
Way cool. Can't wait for you to see it. Way cool piece.
Are you going to have a resident psychiatrist there? I feel like we might.
As a matter of fact, she's an art therapist.
I do have my background. I have my master's in art therapy. So a lot of my pieces do have to go with a psychological. And actually, the title of that piece with the face and the mouth is called Ascending into Consciousness. So it's about
Perfect.
Thoughts and ideas coming up into our consciousness. And
from the shadow self.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you paint a door, do you always picture what's on the other side of it? Do you know what's on the other side of it?
No, I think that's what makes it secret because we don't really know what's going to happen on the other side. I think that's a good metaphor for life because we really don't know what comes in our future. I mean, we can try to make educated decisions, but for the most part, it's usually a surprise.
That's probably a good thing.
It is. I think so. Definitely makes it more interesting.
Gives us a reason to get up every day. What do each of you hope that I'm guessing you want families to come with their children? And what do you want people to think or do or experience when they come to this exhibition?
I really want people to feel that art is more accessible than maybe they do feel. I'd like to attract people that might be uncomfortable in an art situation and invite them to enter that world.
Mm-hmm.
I really want the conversation between the children. Children are so much more open to art and artistic thinking. And so that conversation between the parents and the children, we're liaisoning with schools and organizing field trips to come during the month for this exhibit. So it has all kinds of potential to really attract different people to the Stutz that may not ordinarily come, and to B, spark lots and lots of conversation about what art is and the art and the value to the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Kat, how about you? What are you anticipating or hoping?
Well, I think for any of my shows or pieces that I have, I hope that people kind of get removed from their mundane day-to-day existence and, kind of get pulled into this fantastic, amazing, magical world where anything can happen and, bunny rabbits are taking baths, underground. I mean, just where, things are expansive and just, really just expands your mind and makes you think in different ways. And absolutely, I hope a lot of children will come that maybe this is their first time ever being in a gallery. And maybe from here on out, they're, they say, I want to be an artist. And this is what sparked their, their dream. I mean, that would be fantastic.
Sharon Gamble with Secret Doors exhibit curator Lee Dunnington-Jones and artist Kat Silver. Secret Doors opens on First Friday, October the 7th at the Stutz Art Gallery and runs through October 28th. Find out more at stutzartists.com/events.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
The Architects Home Tour, sponsored by the American Institute of Architects Indianapolis chapter, gives visitors a chance to tour private homes designed by licensed AIA architects. It's become one of the most popular and well-respected home tours in the city. The eight homes on the 2016 Architects Home Tour represent a variety of architectural styles and neighborhoods, giving visitors a chance to see the latest trends in home designs by some of the city's most talented architects. Throughout the two-day event, you'll discover innovative design solutions, and you can meet the design teams, who will talk about the design process and some of their challenges. Sharon Gamble got a sneak peek from co-chair Wes Snyder and committee member Laura Musall.
So let's start with the basics. Remind us what AIA is.
AIA is the American Institute of Architects, and it basically serves to kind of connect architects across the city and the state and the national level, and provide services for members.
So a national service organization, membership-based then,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
do you have to meet certain criteria to be a part of AIA?
There are certain tiers. You can be either a registered architect, associate level like myself, which mm-hmm. basically just means that I work at an office and under an architect, or you can be kind of a sponsorship level, which could be any member of the general public technically.
Cool. And I'm guessing that part of AIA's mission is to educate the public about architecture and
correct
what it means, how to work with an architect, all this
mm-hmm.
kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Normally, somebody doesn't end up working on a home tour unless they've been part of a committee for a year or two. Is that what happened to you?
Yeah, I volunteered for 1 year, and then because we've been having the home tours every 2 years.
Right.
And then I was on the committee last year, and now I'm a co-chair this year.
Yeah, you didn't put your hand down soon enough when somebody said, who would like to co-chair next year, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So is part of your responsibility as co-chair helping to convince homeowners to have their homes on the tour?
Definitely. That takes a little bit of convincing sometimes, along with the architects of that home. The mm-hmm. architect probably does more of the convincing than we do. But sometimes we have to kind of step in and help talk through that process with them. And
why are people hesitant?
Sometimes people think they don't, you know, want a lot of people in their house or kind of coming through certain areas, but we can really work with the homeowner on kind of an intended path or circulation through the house.
So if there's one room where they need to put all the clutter that's normally out.
Right.
Not typically, put that
in a closet,
clutter, yeah.
Or we can even, you know, hide that out of view of the room.
Keep the kids' room off the tour,
right,
or that kind
right.
of thing. Yeah, that's smart.
Yeah.
So as we're having this conversation, you guys just created a cool little video that gives a sneak peek at some of the houses. And, man, you've got some really striking homes. Is there an kind of an organizing principle each year of how to choose the homes?
Typically, we just try to have a variety of different home styles. Like this year, we have contemporary and traditional, as big as 5,000 square feet,
wow.
Meridian Kessler home, and then as small as 1,000 down in Fountain Square.
Hmm.
Typically, we also try to include some renovated homes as well as new. For example, one of the homes in Zionsville, it was your typical average ranch house with a very standard interior.
Mm-hmm.
I think that people will recognize it maybe even from their own homes. And then the architect turned it into a modern farmhouse in Zionsville.
Wow.
And it looks amazing. You can't even tell the difference. It's pretty impressive.
That's a metamorphosis for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
I want to talk about the neon house, the little tiny mm-hmm. house in Fountain Square. Tell
yeah.
us about that one.
That one's about 20 feet wide and I think 80 feet deep.
So it's kind of like a shotgun house from a century or so ago.
Essentially, yeah. It's similar to the shotgun houses in kind of New Orleans or the South.
Mm-hmm.
But utilizing a lot of kind of built-in wall cabinets and multi-functions of space. So,
What was the person who commissioned that house thinking? Is it a single person or somebody who just didn't – who just wanted to live small, maybe moved here from a big mm-hmm. city where they had a tiny condo? Or what's the story?
The architect is actually the homeowner, and he's also my co-chair. That's Brian Birch. His thought – well, I guess thought process would be that he's – it's he and his boyfriend mm-hmm. live there with their dog, and I believe it's two bedroom,
mm-hmm.
but
not as much to clean.
yeah, just trying to live, you know, within as much as you can, or as you absolutely need.
Yeah,
you know, not trying to kind of live lavishly by any means, and also just kind of prove the point that you can. You can do this, and it can look good. So
right, and I've seen a photo of this house, and it looks as though mm-hmm. it has a lot of natural light, which maybe helps to make up for the fact that the space isn't enormous.
It does. There are some enormous windows, and but still a lot of privacy as well. You've kind of got one basically walking up the stairs, one kind of central corridor through the house, and then the rooms are kind of oriented off of that, and then the stairs wrap around and go up to that same kind of corridor. And the rooms are kind of aligned off of that.
For anybody who does Pinterest or pretty much any social media site, the tiny house movement is big. A lot of places. Mm-hmm. I feel as though it might not be quite as big in Indianapolis yet. But are you seeing with your own clients more trend towards how can we downsize? How can mm-hmm. we have less?
Yeah, there definitely is some sort of movement like that coming into Indianapolis, especially with people moving from some of the suburbs, maybe Carmel or Zionsville or Fishers, moving downtown and taking advantage of all the great opportunities that we have now
mm-hmm.
Since the city's grown so much. It just kind of it depends on what their kind of needs are mm-hmm. at that certain time. So
I want to take a little side trip here in your own practice, which your practice is primarily residential.
No, I actually work for Access Architecture,
okay.
and we do commercial.
You're doing commercial interiors then. Yeah.
Well, commercial and residential.
Yeah.
We do a good bit of both.
Yeah. Where do you start with a client? Let's say a client comes in, and I assume that a residential client is as likely to approach you about adding on to or changing up the footprint of an existing home as they are commissioning new. Is that a safe assumption? Or a little bit of
we'd
each?
We'd like it to be more. We welcome additions just as much as a interior remodel or mm-hmm. a brand new house. For instance, the Zionsville farmhouse mm-hmm. or there's a home in Broderpool where they did just that. It was mainly an interior remodel, but they took that bungalow and opened it up, and it looks nothing like anything you would typically see in that area. So I think by hiring an architect, it just gives you an opportunity to kind of change the perspective or give you a little different point of view and kind of critically think through that process of how you can get to a complete, either slightly different or completely different
look
point
and
of view.
Feel,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, because most of us, we move into a house and we think, okay, it's this style. It was built this way. This is kind of it forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it strikes me that these home tours, among other things, remind people that, it may start out as like the Broderpool bungalow you were just talking mm-hmm. about, but at the end it may not have those same characteristics. And so part of your challenge is if I'm a client and I think I might come in and say I need a whole new house, and you might come back and say, tell me about the house you have. What is it you're really looking for? So you've got you've got to play psychologist a little bit there, don't you?
Typically, it also, I'm told by some architects who practice residential more often, is kind of got to play marriage counselor between the two people, or, you know, if it's just one person, even then it's still a little bit of kind of talking and coaxing and, you know, helping somebody envision their dreams, basically.
Yeah.
So
that's
it's a really fun process.
That's part of where the art comes in for you, right?
Definitely, definitely.
Because you get to hear what they're saying and also hear what they're not saying, read between the lines, and, and try to come up with a solution that makes them happy.
Right, but fits with their lifestyle
and
then
their
also
budget.
And their budget.
Yeah.
And then kind of weaves in their interests or their personality a little bit.
Do you have a favorite house that's on this year's tour?
Ooh. That's tough. I usually realize which one my favorite was by the end of the tour, but it's really hard to select one at the beginning.
Tell me something about the Kessler House, which sounds like a real change, a terrific metamorphosis.
Mm-hmm. That one was really interesting. It was tough to read from pictures, and that's what I would strive to everybody. You may want to kind of knock it off the list because it may not be your style, your taste, but really going through that house changed my perception of the space and of the, even as a person in the architectural field, I was really surprised at how open the space felt and just the history of the house and who the original owners were. And the current owners know a lot about the history and can kind of talk you through how the house came together initially. The original owner was a doctor, and he actually saw patients within the house.
Oh,
so
really?
There's a cool side door at the back, and the study, and how all the kind of all the rooms linked together was really interesting. But A3 did a really nice job of being able to take down some walls and open the space up, as well as add some small details that kind of help to fit in the style, but still kind of bring the traditional home more kind of into the 21st century. So
my memory is that there are architects, if not the architect who did each house, then at least architects staffing pretty much all the homes on this tour. Do I remember that correctly? So that, and or homeowners, so that you really get the inside story.
Right, mostly. Typically, there's the architect and usually the homeowners inside the house during the tour to kind of give people either a backstory as to kind of the design process, as well as history about the home, about themselves, et cetera.
What do you want people to, other than the thrill of seeing how other people live, what do you want people who come on the tour to know after they've gone on this tour, or to think about after they've gone on this tour?
I guess one of the biggest things is being able to kind of understand more what architects do. I think a lot of people don't really understand what we do as a profession. And to understand that it's not just big buildings or skyscrapers, or it's not only extremely wealthy clients that hire architects. It could be the average Joe. It could be anybody. And we can help solve, you know, any design problem from a, like I said before, a remodel to, treehouse addition, or, you know, something interesting and fun. We love those really tough, difficult problems because that's our job. That's what we love to figure out, tinker with.
Sharon Gamble with Wes Snyder and Laura Musall, two of the organizers of this year's AIA Architects Home Tour. It's Saturday and Sunday, October 15th and 16th. You can get a taste of the homes at AIAIndieHomeTour.com. And you can also see a sneak preview video if you search for AIA Indie Home Tour 2016 on YouTube.
Hey, Jill.
Yes, Sharon.
I understand you have some big news about a fabulous entity in Fountain Square.
I do.
Yeah.
The Hi-Fi. They're expanding.
They're expanding.
Because Imoca is moving. So it's kind of a give and take up there.
I love it. So room for more music and a chance for Imoca to reinvent itself and go someplace else.
Find a new
venue.
Do
some new things. That's right.
But the Hi-Fi, they bring in a lot of local acts. It's a great place. And now they'll be, I think, be able to
accommodate the demand,
up to like
right?
400 people, Ooh-hoo. Which would be amazing.
Fabulous. All right.
Good news for them.
We have more to tell you about that and some other things on our calendar that we call
What Do We Do?
So I liked the Vogue manager's comment that makes Hi-Fi a little bit more of a, like, the AAA ball club feeding up to the Vogue size venue.
I think that's a great simile for that.
Yeah. So what else is going on this week or so?
Well, they're speaking about local music and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
We've got a big 3-day music weekend coming up here downtown on the American Legion. It's the Evermore Music Festival. And a lot of those bands that play in the Hi-Fi actually are going to be here. Audio Audacity and High Rider. But this is real diverse. You've got DJ Slater Hogan. Then you've got the Flatland Harmony Experiment. You've got all different genres of music for 3 days at this outdoor festival on the American Legion lawn in downtown Indianapolis. And of course, you know, if there's going to be 35 bands, there's got to be food trucks. There'll be food trucks. And they're going
to
have some
energy to keep listening, right?
You do. And they're going to throw some art vendors in there and some games, of course.
Yeah.
So something for everybody at the evermoremusicfestival.com to get the entire rundown.
What a trip. On a whole different kind of musical platform, the season opener at the Phoenix Theater this week is Peter and the Starcatcher. It's actually, okay, I'm going to say words that you probably didn't think you would hear, which is family friendly and Phoenix Theater in the same sentence. Family friendly musical. It's a prequel about Peter Pan. So you can find out about Peter Pan and the Lost Boys and the pirates and more and see how the story all began. So now you know what happens before the traditional story of Peter Pan. That's on the Phoenix Theater stage through October 23rd. And you will believe, and you might get to clap your hands.
at least, if they did that in before Peter Pan days, since it's the prequel.
We'll have to go and see.
That's intriguing to me. Believe it or not, October the 1st, Scotty's Brewhouse, they're all over town. It's their 20th anniversary. That'll make
That's
me feel
a
old.
That's a lot of fried pickle chips and a lot of beer.
They're big supporters of the arts around town, too. And they're having their big their anniversary party at their 96th Street location. And the Y Store is going to be there. They're a great local band.
Oh, wow.
Plus the Chosen Few and Mike and Joe, too. You get there's going to be a dunk tank, ski ball. Giant Jenga, cornhole, the whole deal. So you get the whole food music experience at the Scotty's Brewhouse, and congratulations to them.
Man, there's a lot of music going on in town this weekend. This Sunday at 4 o'clock at Pilgrim Lutheran Church, it's Women Make Music, the piano duo of Rebecca Sorley and Allegra Sorley. Lots of beautiful music. There's a free will offering and two really accomplished pianists. So you can go check that out. It's Pilgrim Lutheran Church, 4 o'clock this Sunday, October 2nd. Hard to believe it's October already.
Unbelievable. And if you need to find your art in the air, the Red Bull Air Race is going on out at the Motor Speedway. They're always doing something interesting out there Saturday and Sunday on that, too.
Speaking of things in the air, there might be ghosts in the air this Saturday at Crown Hill Cemetery. The ghosts are going to be interpreted by Storytelling Arts of Indiana's tellers. Ghost Stories at Crown Hill, one of their most popular performances of the year. Gates open at 5:30, stories from 7:30 to 10:30. There's also an RIP reception. Creepy, creepy, creepy. For
maybe the last one you'll go
lovers.
To this year. Who knows?
Well, now, don't scare them.
Spooky.
Spooky
stuff. And First Friday is actually October 7th. So there's all different kinds of galleries that you can go visit and see in downtown Indianapolis on October the 7th for the First Friday of
Absolutely.
October.
And speaking of change of seasons and change of months, the IMA's Family Day Harvest Festival is this Saturday from 1 to 5. It's included with general admission, free for IMA. IMA members, autumn-themed activities, stunning pumpkin and gourd displays, hay rides, seasonal food tastings, live music and family activities all afternoon long, and a special cereal cinema screening of Coraline in the Toby on Saturday.
What if you had cinnamon cereal at the cereal
cinema? I think
cinema.
That's what I was thinking of. And don't forget, you can learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide, the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide, or listen to our calendar next week that we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your hosts today are Sharon Gamble and Jill Dittmeyer. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
Folk music serves as a strong inspiration for the classical chamber music featured on this year's Ronin Chamber Ensemble season. As Sharon heard from clarinetist David Bellman and pianist Gregory Martin, along with David's wife Ingrid Fisher Bellman, they are the artistic directors of the ensemble, which is one of the longest performing chamber music groups in Indianapolis.
David, take us back to the beginning, 30, how many years ago? How many, 30?
According to my reckoning, this is our 33rd season starting. So back in 1983, we incorporated and formed the ensemble, and we found there to be somewhat of a need for some more chamber music here in Indianapolis, and we felt the need to play some more chamber music since, I mean, playing in the orchestra, of course, is a wonderful outlet and the greatest repertoire out there, but
sure,
playing chamber music is the greatest repertoire out there also, and so we wanted to have more chances to do that and to make some decisions on our own about what we'd play. And so we formed an ensemble and started playing at the Lyman and Snodgrass Gallery, which, of course, is non-existent now. But and so that's how we started, and it's hard to believe that it's that many years ago.
What was your intent in choosing the particular – well, what is the particular niche you occupy, and then how did you arrive at that?
We noticed that there were a lot of string-oriented groups and string quartets and woodwind quintets, but not so many that were offering a wide variety of the mixture of that. So we myself being a clarinetist, of course, decided to make it have a wind emphasis on the repertoire we chose, and
because you're married to a cellist,
funny thing there, yeah. And since being married to a cellist, who we were married just about a year before we started the ensemble, and of course we have a number of trios that we can play together by Brahms and Beethoven.
Sure.
And Muchinsky, of course, a little lesser known. So we made it wind and string emphasis rather than one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
And we also started very early on being fairly regular about commissioning a new composer. We will be carrying on that tradition. Mm-hmm. With this season, with a new work by Matthew Bridgham, which will, if any of you happen to have one of our brochures, if any of your listeners have a brochure in hand, it will not be appearing on our first concert for reasons beyond our control, but it will actually happen in January on our second concert. But we will have that world premiere then, and we're we will play, well, I won't, but some violinist will play a new duo by John Berners, who's here on the faculty at UIndy.
Oh, fantastic.
And we decided we needed to have the promised new piece. It won't be the world premiere. It was premiered at a festival in Washington State a few months ago this past summer, but it will definitely be the Indianapolis and Indiana premiere of, I think, the second performance of the works, which are nine duos for two violins.
Fantastic. Indianapolis has much more than would first meet the eye going on with new music. And you and the ensemble have been a part of helping that happen.
Well, we've definitely, as I said, we've definitely tried to make that a priority. I've lost count by now, but I know we've premiered more than 20 works over these 33 years, and of course played a number of other recently composed works that weren't premieres.
Right. And Gregory, I want to bring you into the conversation. You mentioned before we turned the microphones on that your wife is a clarinetist and studied with David, but do you remember your first experience of the Ronin Chamber Ensemble?
Yeah, it was actually while I was a student at IU in Bloomington. My teacher, Edmund Battersby, was playing with Ronin, I think, Dognagni, the quintet.
And
sextet.
Luscious.
And so he invited us all up, so we came up to hear them. And then when I met my wife at school, and we were playing some concerts together, and she said something up here and invited her former clarinet teacher from high school, and he was in the audience, and afterwards I met him. And I told her afterwards, that was the guy that my teacher played with, and I remember it from that concert. So that was sort of the beginning of that connection.
Sweet. How did you end up with piano? What led you to piano?
I have no idea. The story my mom tells is that I signed myself up for piano lessons in kindergarten, and they called home to confirm that this was okay. And she said, there must be some mistake. We don't own a piano. And so in retrospect, what they should have done was cancel the lessons. Instead, they went out and found a piano. And I started playing, and that was that.
The rest is history.
Yep.
And we're all very happy about that.
Yeah, there was something that spoke to you about it. You'd seen performances somewhere. Did your classroom have a piano?
No. There was nothing like that. I have no idea why that happened. It just did. So, yeah, there's no logical reason for it as far as I can tell.
Art works in mysterious ways. Yeah. So I know that there's a little delay. Sometimes before we turn the microphones on, we were talking about Rossini being locked in a room while he was composing something because he hadn't met his deadline to get the music to the orchestra that was going to play it. But I want to talk a little bit about process. So the piece Matthew Bridgham is writing for you is a quartet for clarinet, violin, cello, and piano. How much back and forth have you guys had, or is it just you made the commission, you said, here are the instruments we want it to be, go off and write it and then present it whole to us? Is it something in between those two ends of the spectrum, or a lot of back and forth, or how's that work?
We had some interchange with ideas, even about the instrumentation at first. We talked at first about possibly having a fifth instrument, another wind instrument, but we ultimately settled on this very classic ensemble, which of course Messiaen made famous with his quartet for the End of Time, and Matt Bridgham felt most comfortable working with that ensemble, so we stuck with that. But we definitely had some conversations over the instrumentation, and then we did want to help commemorate the 200th anniversary of Indiana.
Right.
And so that came up also in the conversation. We initially talked about maybe including some folk elements of music from Indiana in this piece, but that also was not to Matt's pleasing. So there are other ways in which this will help celebrate that centennial,
yeah, cool.
But it won't actually have any Hoosier tunes in it.
Yeah, that's okay. We don't. Without quoting from other composers' work, there it's not as though we have lots and lots of native folk music from Indiana. So a little bit harder to source material. It's not like it's Ireland or England. Right? this is a season that celebrates singing qualities, right? The human voice is channeled in some different ways. The very first concert coming up in a couple of weeks, October 18th. In Vuxton, folk inspiration in chamber music. So this is the organizing principle of this concert and a little bit for the season.
Yes, well, that's more the two of the composers on this program, Vaughan Williams and Sibelius, were both collectors of folk music from their respective countries, and that's where we got the title In Vuxton, which is German for in a folk way.
Yeah, there's actually a collection for cello and piano by Schumann entitled that. Mm-hmm. So,
but
that worked out as a,
and again, yeah. So the concert definitely is centered around that theme of folk music, and we're playing his quintet for violin, clarinet, horn, cello, and piano, which I'm not sure has ever been played in an Indianapolis area, not that I recall hearing.
Vaughan Williams, outside of orchestral works and maybe limited to 3 or 5, Vaughan Williams isn't programmed a lot any place, sadly, so thanks for doing that.
Oh, well, that we can thank Greg for that. That's a piece that he was well familiar with, and we're very much looking forward to the performance of that. And we also have Sibelius, his pieces for cello and piano, which Ingrid will be playing. And this, of course, will be her first return to the formal chamber music stage in over a year because of her shoulder surgery last year. And she's very much looking forward to coming back and playing these tuneful works with Greg.
Sure, I'll bet. And then on to piano quartets in January. And tell us a little bit about how you find the instrumental balance for a concert. Does everybody who traditionally plays in the ensemble come at the beginning of in the planning stages of a season and say, here are some works I think would fit in this season, and then you say, well, it'd be more efficient to do this and this, or what's that process like?
Well, it's changed a little bit over the last, say, 3 years when Greg came on board as one of our co-artistic directors, and we're finding a little more piano in the mix than, I mean, we've always had pianists playing and working with us, but now Greg, of course, does all or for the most part, all of the piano playing on our concerts, and so he has a treasure trove of repertoire that he comes up with that maybe Ingrid and I might be a little less familiar with. The Vaughan Williams is a good example of that. It's a wonderful early work of his. Isn't it a student work, actually? Mm-hmm. And a somewhat unusual instrumentation, but it's perfect for a Ronan concert with its. We have a string, we have two winds, we have and the piano, of course, and it's a terrific contribution to our repertoire.
That has to be really gratifying, even after playing more than 3 decades together, to find works you haven't played yet.
Oh yeah,
you didn't know.
we're it's gratifying. It's also challenging because we can't rely on those old standards. We're still learning new works, and it's a lot of fun to be doing that. And Greg is a wonderful colleague and performer, and it's brought a lot of new life back into Ronin to have him on board.
Sharon Gamble with clarinetist David Bellman and pianist Gregory Martin of the Ronin Chamber Ensemble. Their season begins on Tuesday, October 17th, with a concert called Im Volkstan, folk inspiration in chamber music at the Wood Room of Hilbert Circle Theater. You'll hear music of Sibelius, Vaughan Williams, and more. And learn more about this concert and the rest of the season at roninchamber.org.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buselli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com. In honor of the Art of the Matter's 17th anniversary, we're changing up our program beginning next week, starting with going back to making the first airing on Saturday mornings at 7 and the repeat on Thursday evenings at 8.
And there are lots more surprises in store, too, including a weekly segment from A Cultural Manifesto.
Plus a report on food and drink from Eat Drink Indiana Radio.
And a lot of other treats, too. But don't worry, we'll still have that arts calendar that we call
What'll We Do? So don't miss the all-new version of The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. Your hosts today are Sharon Gamble and Jill Dittmeyer. Today's show was edited by Melissa Davis and produced by Roxana Caldwell. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.